This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, it's not an easy answer how to do those things all within the limited water that nature provides us, but we know we can't ignore those demands any longer.
As Californians continue to look beseechingly to the skies for signs of any kind of rainfall, the effects of this drought are indeed far-reaching. The policies that emerge from this disastrously dry year may ultimately alter what foods we eat, where we build new homes, and even what sports we play. Earlier this year, we heard from the president of the Pacific Institute, Peter Glick, as he told us of the critical nature of this drought, even in its early stages. Today on Sea Change Radio, I speak again to Dr. Glick for an update and to get a glimpse into the future of what a permanently drier California might mean for us all. Welcome back to Sea Change Radio. Peter Glick, he's the president of the Pacific Institute. Peter, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
The last time we spoke this past winter, Peter, there were lots of dire predictions about a continuing dry spell in California, and those forecasts have become reality as the drought continues to worsen. First, can you give our listeners around the country a quick update on where things stand for California right now in terms of its water management issues?
Yeah, so the short version of that is we're in a really deep hole. The longer version is our rainy season goes from October through the winter till perhaps March. When we last spoke, it was already beginning to look like it was going to be dry on top of a couple of previous below normal years. And that's the way it developed. It has been extraordinarily dry, and the state has seen its drought classification expand in terms of area. So 100% of the state is now in drought. And in terms of severity, we're now in largely what we call extraordinary drought. It's worse than severe. It's quite remarkably dry. And not only has it been dry, it's been extremely hot as well, which is, of course, a climate change issue. And the combination of that and the combination of the fact that the last couple of years have also been dry means we've really drawn down our reservoirs. Our soil moisture is really disappeared. Our groundwater aquifers are being overpumped, and people are calling it the worst, if not one of the worst droughts on record, and there's no end in sight.
Yes, it's pretty dismal. And how much water does California have left? I've seen ranges that are quite wide.
Well, so that's a tough thing to answer. We do know that our rainy season starts again in October. It's not, you know, we're going to get some precipitation in the form of snow and rain. We don't know how much. If it's below normal, that's even more pressure on the existing system. If it's normal, you know, we'll barely scrape by because that even in a normal year, there's not really enough water to go around. If it's a really wet year, we have the opportunity to satisfy needs next year, but also potentially to recharge groundwater to refill some of our reservoirs. You know, we're not going to run out of water. There will be some water next season. There is a little bit of water left in the reservoirs. And then we have this underground water system. We have groundwater in our aquifers. And some of that water is laid down over hundreds and hundreds of years. It's a huge resource, but it's being very, very heavily overdrafted. So the issue isn't, are we going to suck it dry? But the issue is, are we going to be able to maintain, if it's a dry year next year, are we going to be able to maintain the demands at the current level? And I think the answer to that is going to be no.
Well, I just wanted to read Jay Famiglietti's op-ed in the LA Times. And he says, the harsh reality is that everything here was fine. We used to have a lot of water in California, but now we don't. Without a few successive winters of above average precipitation, we have only enough water in storage to get through the next 12 to 18 months, and that's it. Beyond that, many of our state and local water managers have thrown up their hands because they just don't know where our water will come from. Now, someone hears that 12 to 18 months, try to explain to our listeners what that really means.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the 12 to 18, where that comes from.
Okay.
What Jay is, I think, looking at in part is the amount of water that's in our surface storage reservoirs, which are the artificial reservoirs that we built to deal with this kind of thing. You know, we have variable rainfall and precipitation normally. We have wet years, we have dry years. Increasingly, it's hard to find an average year now. And so we built a lot of surface storage to store water in the wet years so we can use it in the dry years. And the last 3 years have been dry, and those reservoirs have gotten us through a lot of that and permitted us not to take the actions that I think we probably should have been taking. We've continued to deliver water, even though it's been very dry, drawing down those reservoirs. They're pretty far down now. Now, you know, again, we will get some water in the winter. That'll satisfy some of the demands next year. We'll draw down the reservoirs to their ultimate limit if we have to. But when there's no water to fill a reservoir, not enough to fill it, then ultimately the bathtub's empty, and those reservoirs may have served their purpose, but they don't help us any longer. We do have groundwater. We do have a lot of groundwater potentially if we're willing to spend the money to pump it, to drill the wells, and to pump it out. But even that's not sustainable. Again, imagine a big bathtub, and if you take more out than you put in, the level drops and it gets more expensive and difficult to find. And it's like living on your savings account without recharging it. And that's what we've been doing the last several years at a minimum.
There's also, I've read that these things can go in decade-long cycles, up to 3, 5 years, even 10 years. Who are we to believe, Peter?
Well, so that's certainly true. There is record from the paleoclimate record, that is looking at ancient climates, looking at tree rings, looking at soil patterns and pollen records that give us some hints of the extent of past wet years and dry years, really going back 1,000 years or longer in California. And we do see in that record fairly long periods of drought have occurred in the ancient past, in the distant past. And so, of course, we don't know whether we're in a long-term cycle because we never know if these droughts are going to go on until they end. You know, we don't know if yet next year is going to be wet or dry. We're not capable of predicting that. This is a very dry year. The last 3 years have been dry. If you actually go back a little farther, 10 of the last 14 years have been dry. So I think we're getting a little bit of an eye opener here in the extent to which, into how we think about drought. It's no longer enough to think about this as a short-term problem. This is a long-term problem. And it's worsened by the fact that even in a normal year now in California, and Jay, I think, was hinting at this, even in a normal year, there's not enough water to go around to meet all of the demands. We've given away water rights to 5 times the average flow of water in California. Now, everybody knows not everybody will get everything they want. But even in a normal year, we're having trouble meeting our demands for urban and agricultural and environmental water. All three of those things are important. And so the drought it's sort of a crisis, but it's also an indication of things to come.
What is environmental water?
Well, so in the 20th century, the way we thought about water was figuring out how to supply human demands for water, urban demands for homes and industry and commercial use and institutional use. And agricultural demands for water. California is a fantastic place to grow food. The climate is wonderful, normally. the soils in the Central Valley are superb. Agriculture takes a tremendous amount of the water that we use as humans. But we didn't think about the ecosystem demands for water, the water required to support fisheries and our wetlands and the flyways for the massive Pacific bird populations that move up and down our coasts in the fall and then again in the spring. And because we didn't think about the environment, we took water out for human uses and we caused a lot of very serious environmental damage. And in the 20th century, we didn't know about the importance of that or we didn't care. And that's no longer true. Ecosystem demands are now an important part of the conversation about water policy in California and the Western U.S. as a whole, and frankly, globally. And so we're thinking about how to balance those three demands, the agricultural, urban, and environmental needs for water, and to protect fisheries and to restore river flow and river health. You know, it's not an easy answer how to do those things all within the limited water that nature provides us, but we know we can't ignore those demands any longer.
I don't care if the sun don't shine. I get my loving in the evening time when I'm with my baby. It's no fun with the sun around, but I get going when the sun goes down and I meet my baby. That's when we kiss and kiss and kiss, and then we kiss some more. Don't ask how many times we kiss at a time like this. Who keeps score? So I don't care if the sun don't shine. I get my loving in the evening time when I'm with my baby.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Peter Glick. He's the president of the Pacific Institute. Can you talk about some of the saner water policies in either in other governments or in other states that have, if we had been following this here in California over the last couple of decades, we might not be in this pickle?
Well, I guess the definition of sane water policy is changing over time. Again, in the 20th century, smart water policy was designed by engineers primarily and urban planners, and the purpose was to satisfy whatever human demands came along, to build the infrastructure, to move water around, to treat water. And we built a lot of very important, vital water-related infrastructure in the 20th century.
But conservation was never really an element of that, right? It was always just, let's turn the spigots on and make sure everybody has enough.
That's right. When there was enough to go around, it wasn't a problem. We didn't have to think about efficiency and conservation. We didn't really have to think about ecosystems. But unfortunately, there are real constraints, and the 21st century has got to be a period of time when we acknowledge that we're running into the limits of a whole range of things. This isn't just a water issue. There are limits to our ability to modify and insult the climate, and that's what the climate change debate is all about. We've gotten to the point where we're actually influencing the climate. We've gotten to the point in our water systems where we're at what we call peak water. We might want more water out of something like the Colorado River, which is the major river in the southwestern U.S., but we already use it all, and we can't have any more. And when we reach these kinds of limits, peak limits on groundwater extraction, when it's non-renewable, you run into limits and economic and environmental limits, and then you have to start to rethink what you do. And our water policy in the 21st century has got to shift from a focus on finding new supply to a focus on really long-term sustainable management. And that includes demand management and efficiency. It includes innovative new ideas for supply. You know, there may be no new water out of the Colorado River or out of our groundwater aquifers, but there are a lot of new supplies in terms of recycled water and reuse of water. We spend a lot of time and money collecting wastewater, and we treat it to a pretty good standard. And in the past, we've thrown it away. But that's a new source of supply that increasingly water agencies are looking at. Stormwater capture and reuse is a new source of supply. Desalination is a potential new source of supply with its own economic and environmental challenges. But there are a whole new set of ideas out there that I think are really going to be valuable for us.
So obviously California is different from many other states and even countries because of its wide-ranging topography, population centers, agriculture, and overall water demands. But are there templates from other countries that we can look toward for solutions, Peter?
Sure. So the good news is that there are really innovative things going on all over the world, even in California, in terms of improvements in efficiency in the way we use water, in terms of smart meters for monitoring water use and giving feedback to customers about that water use so they can change their technology or their behavior. Singapore has been a really, I'd say, a world leader in expanding the use of recycled water for all sorts of purposes, up to and including potable reuse, actually treating water to a perfectly potable standard, incredibly high quality standard, and considering it for potable reuse.
How did that get put into place? And do you know, have any idea of what the average Singaporean's water bill looks like?
Yeah, so the story in Singapore is, you know, Singapore is sort of an island city state. It's relatively small. They have very limited natural water availability, and a lot of their water came from Malaysia, which brought with it not just water, but some political concerns about water security. They have a government that is willing to take actions for to charge the reasonable prices for water and to build infrastructure to treat water to a very high standard. And they worked very, very hard on conservation and efficiency as well, and on education to their population about what their water problems are and what the solutions are and how to move forward. So it's sort of been a combination of smart technology and smart economic pricing of water and smart communications and education that's permitted Singapore to really move forward in a pretty effective way to address their water challenges. But another quick example, Namibia in southern Africa has also strongly committed for many, many years to water treatment and reuse because it's a very water short country. They have very few options. A total different kind of political and economic system than Singapore, which is a pretty wealthy country. But Namibia has done a good job in that area as well.
We have to look towards these other innovative countries that may have valued water at an earlier stage in their existence.
Yeah, so decisions about water or decisions about resources in general are made by countries and states and regions and localities for different kinds of reasons. Sometimes they're driven by economic factors and pricing. Sometimes they're driven by things like absolute scarcity or availability of technology, and sometimes they're driven by social and political preferences.
Can you give us an example, Peter?
Yeah, so for example, a very, very severe drought in Australia, starting in the year 2000, led to the kinds of policy responses that we're seeing in California now. The, we're going to muddle through, we'll draw down our reservoirs, we'll try and educate the public about conservation and efficiency, but we won't fundamentally change what we do. But that drought continued. It turned into a 3-year, then a 4-year, then a 5-year, then ultimately that was a 9-year severe drought. And at the end of that period, the kinds of policies that they put in place were completely different. They had made dramatic changes in public perception about water use, willingness to give up lawns, willingness to fundamentally change water rights structures between agriculture and cities. They had a really serious conversation about ecosystem protection and restoration. We're driven by necessity, and the kinds of things we're doing now in California, they're moving in the right direction. But if the drought continues, I think we'll see political and economic pressure to do much, much more than we're doing now. And there's potential to do much, much more than we're doing now. That's maybe the good news.
Can you talk maybe about some of the more effective measures that Las Vegas has taken in terms of water?
Las Vegas has been very aggressive on indoor water conservation. I'm sorry, on outdoor water conservation.
In terms of like golf courses and things like that, right?
Well, for example, they were one of the first municipalities, if not the first, to offer what we now have nicknamed sort of cash for grass programs to pay people to take out their lawns and replace them with native vegetation, you know, nice gardens, but low water using gardens.
And Los Angeles is just implemented that program, right?
And now Los Angeles, Long Beach has implemented it, Los Angeles is implementing it, and is, as the drought gets worse, is raising the amount of money they're offering. And it's beginning to be very effective. That was something that Las Vegas did pretty well. Tucson has been also very good on outdoor landscape and indoor water conservation programs. Phoenix has not been quite as aggressive. I mean, it really varies from city to city, depending on their water availability and depending on the local politics and so on. I think there are innovative things going on in a lot of different places, and really the challenge is to identify them and adopt the ones that make the most sense for wherever you are.
When the sun shines, they slip into the shade. Drink the sunshine.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Peter Glick. He's the president of the Pacific Institute. Now, I know it's a first world problem, and I know that there's many more far-reaching effects from a drought of this magnitude. I don't mean to sound callous, but if you're looking to invest in a ski resort these days, how much of a role would climate change come into your purchasing decision?
Let me start by saying this. Climate change is real. We see it happening. It's happening because of human activities. The consensus in the scientific community is incredibly strong on that. We know that humans are changing the climate as much as we know that smoking tobacco can cause cancer.
Sure. Yeah, we don't have a climate change debate here on Sea Change Radio.
Indeed. And the impacts of climate change are going to be incredibly pervasive. They're going to be felt by everybody, ultimately, in almost every aspect of our lives. And I'm happy to talk about the ski industry, but we should know that there are much more serious fundamental impacts of climate change that are coming down the road to agriculture, to coastal communities. But the reality is, partly our awareness about these things depends on whether or not they affect things we care about and affect us personally. And so it's a perfectly legitimate question, because it will be a big impact of climate change. It'll be one that we'll see pretty soon, too, if we're not already seeing it.
Outside of California, where are some of the areas, if you were the governor of a state or the president of a country, and water had not really been a big trouble point for your populace, how is climate change going to affect some unlikely places?
Well, so again, the impacts of climate change will vary enormously around the world. If I'm the president of a country with a very extensive coastline or a South Pacific island nation, boy, would I be worried about sea level rise. That's a fundamental existential threat. It's a threat to the existence of my country.
Freshwater and any other resources, just life on that in that area will be affected greatly, is what you're saying.
Oh, that's right. I mean, you know, you asked, you know, what do I think about investing in the ski industry? I wouldn't invest in coastal property either within any foot or two of sea level rise, certainly, or even larger. Mm-hmm. But, you know, increasingly, it's also apparent that we have a growing problem with extreme events, storm patterns, storm frequency and intensity, hurricane patterns, blocking patterns out of the Arctic as the Arctic disappears, is causing really dramatic changes in temperature patterns and weather patterns around the world, including in the United States. We've already seen some of those. I would worry about that. I certainly, if I live in an area that's dependent on snowfall and snowmelt, obviously from a recreational point of view, skiing is going to be increasingly problematic, but so is water management broadly. The timing of water availability from the mountains in the Rocky Mountains, the Sierra Nevada in California, the Himalayas, the Andes, the Alps, is dramatically going to be affected and is already being affected by rising temperatures. As more of what falls out of the sky falls as rain rather than snow, that's going to be a water management problem. There are going to be problems with agricultural production, where we can grow what. Yields are going to change. It's going to be harder and harder to grow certain kinds of crops where temperature limits are a factor. It might be a little easier to go grow crops in more northern latitudes, although the soils tend not to be as good in many of those places. There are lots of challenges.
Can you speak about our aquifers and the non-renewable groundwater supplies that are being drained at unsustainable rates? How do they work, and how long do we have to lean on them as a resource?
Well, we depend on surface water. We depend on groundwater in different proportions around the world. In California, in a normal year, about 40% of our water supply is groundwater that's pumped out of our underground aquifers and badly regulated and monitored. So groundwater is water that's underground. It got there by precipitation falling on the ground, and it seeps into the soil and then further down into deeper layers. And the geology of groundwater, it's not a big bathtub down there. It's not a big pool of water. It's water that's in the interstices in the rocks and the soils. And there are different kinds of groundwater aquifers, but there's a vast amount of groundwater in different parts of the world that's been laid down over often millennia, tens of thousands of years even, as precipitation seeps into the soil and further down. And so when you drill a well, into the ground. Sometimes you hit water and you can pump that water out. And sometimes that water is very high quality because it's been there for a long time. But if you pump it out faster than nature recharges it, then it's not sustainable. It's like oil, and the groundwater levels will drop. Sometimes there are water quality problems caused by overpumping of groundwater. And so smart management of groundwater involves understanding what you can take out on a renewable basis and managing groundwater carefully. And we don't do that very well in California or in other places like China or northern India, where our use of groundwater is really non-renewable. It's unsustainable over the long term.
So, Peter, what new water restrictions do Californians have to look forward to as this drought continues?
Well, hopefully it will rain in the coming rainy season. But barring a really, really substantial increase in water availability, we are going to see more restrictions and more changes in water policy and water use. For homeowners, I think if the drought continues, we're going to see voluntary restrictions change to mandatory restrictions. I think we're going to see new incentives to change our outdoor landscaping, which is really a high volume consumptive use of water, efforts to get people to remove their lawns and replace them with much more water efficient gardens. I think we'll see incentives to swap out inefficient fixtures indoors, like toilets and showerheads, washing machines, dishwashers, for more efficient fixtures. I think we'll see institutional groups like universities and government agencies removing lawns more and more, and outdoor landscaping. I think on the agricultural side, we're going to see more and more fallowing. If there really isn't a lot of water next year, farmers are going to be forced to pull crops out of production because there simply won't be enough water to grow all of the crops that we like to grow in a normal year or a wet year.
And plant different crops as well. Is that what you're saying?
We'll see changes in crop types. We're seeing that already. And we'll see changes in irrigation practices as farmers figure out how to make their limited allocations of water go farther. That's an improvement in efficiency, and that's a good thing. We've seen changes in that direction already, and I think we'll see a lot more of that.
Peter Glick, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. Sway the future to the past and find what will
endure. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Meters, Dean Martin, and Greg Allman. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.